to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. Today I wanted to do something a little more, more creative than just another repeat. So part of today is replaying an interview with Steve Kraft from last September. Steve Kraft is now the former CEO of the Guelph Public Library. He retired last week. I was at his retirement party at the main library on Thursday. And very nice affair, great turnout. But the library is now leaderless for the first time in over a decade. The committee, or I should say the board of directors for the library, is presently embarking on a recruitment drive for a new CEO. But given the occasion, I thought it would be interesting to replay this interview, which turned out to be an exit interview of a sort, that we did with Steve Kraft last summer, shortly after the groundbreaking of the new main library, perhaps the pinnacle of his tenure as the CEO, finally getting that project going. If you walk past the Baker District today, it's a big hole in the ground as they're building the underground parking structure. The actual library itself will begin construction later this year sometime. So, we're going to play that interview with Steve Kraft in a bit. First, a very SEO-friendly segment, given the enormous success of Dune 2 last weekend at the box office. I was among them. I was one of the, 20% of ticket sales that went to IMAX screenings. I saw Dune Part 2 in IMAX down in Toronto. And boy, was that a great experience. I mean, seeing anything on the big screen is great. Seeing it on IMAX is incredible, especially something like Dune 2, which was filmed on IMAX, if I'm remembering correctly. So, fits the format. Its epicness and scale is also appropriate. But a couple of years ago on End Credits, I ranked the films of Denis Villeneuve. Now, what inspired this was I was listening to another podcast, and they were talking about the films of Denis Villeneuve. But they started at Prisoners, which was actually his, like, fourth or fifth film. I think it was his fifth film. And his first Hollywood film. Before that, Villeneuve had done several Canadian films, including most notably Incendie, which was nominated for Best Foreign Language Film at the Oscars about 12, 13 years ago. He also did Polytechnique, which was this like just heart-wrenching sort of docudrama recreation of the terrorist attack on L'École Polytechnique in 1989. He also had a couple of, like, kind of goofy films there at the beginning. But anyway, this erasure of Denis Villeneuve's French-Canadian cinema start just would not stand, in my humble opinion. So I want to replay this, which we did on End Credits in September 2021, shortly before the release of Dune Part 1, of this ranking of Villeneuve's, all of Villeneuve's movies, right up until Dune Part 1. So Dune Part 1 isn't in the ranking. If I'm amending things, I did find my notes from that episode. I would put it somewhere probably in the middle, somewhere between Incendie and Polytechnique. So like the 5 or 6 area. Dune Part 2, too much recency bias to place that on the list. It's probably pretty high because I think that's a better film than Dune Part 1. But either way, from August the 32nd to Blade Runner 2049, you're going to get that definitive ranking of the Denis Villeneuve films. That's going to be up first. After that, the podcast with Steve Kraft from last year. I'll be back to wrap up the show at the end. All right, so at number 9 spot, I've put the 32nd of August on Earth. It's his first movie. It came out in 1998. I mean, there was obviously a lot of talent on display. But the 32nd of August, first of all, they never explained what is that supposed to mean, because there are several segments at the beginning where it's like the 32nd of August, the 33rd of August, the 35th of August, and then it goes into September, and it's like, what does that even mean? I don't know. It's something that was used to chop this movie into parts, and what's weird about it is It's the story of these two friends. One is a model, and she's kind of having a midlife crisis after she got into a car accident. Well, not a midlife crisis, but an early life crisis. She gets into a car accident. She goes to her best friend, Philippe, and says, like, hey, let's have a baby together. And he's like, okay, but I have to go to the desert in order to copulate with you. And so they take a last-minute trip to Salt Lake City so they can make love in the desert so he can get her pregnant. It's basically a Kevin Smith movie, but with the cinematic stylings of Denis Villeneuve. Like, you can see obvious talent on the screen, but Denis Villeneuve has not since gotten this goofy. I may be wrong about that. Hold my beer on that. But it's an interesting film nonetheless. Beautifully shot. The landscapes of the white sands outside Salt Lake City are beautifully captured. It's a beautiful film. Goofy. Incredibly goofy, but beautiful to watch. At number 8, I have Enemy, and this was Villeneuve's follow-up to Prisoners, which was this big sort of American Hollywood breakthrough. He then came back to Toronto, came back to Canada, and filmed this story, which is features Jake Gyllenhaal, who was in Prisoners. He plays this sort of sad sack history teacher who leading this life of routine, and he inexplicably rents a movie one day and sees an actor who looks mysteriously exactly like him and ends up stalking him, and they end up meeting, and, you know, personal decisions are made, things are revealed. It's very Lynchian. By that I mean David Lynch. I'm not sure. I know it doesn't work 100% because I didn't work for me. It's just, it's really hard to sort of, it's not hard to watch. And the actors are really good, but it's like, what does any of this mean? If you're going to go Lynch, you got to go full Lynch, which is to, like, literally try and put no cap on what it is the audience is supposed to think. Like, the film tries to introduce the idea that maybe the Jake Gyllenhaal character is leading two lives, like maybe he has two different personalities, but at the same time, like, there are events in the film that make it very, very clear that these are two separate people. So what is exactly going on? Does Jake Gyllenhaal's history teacher have an evil actor twin? Who knows? It's very ambiguous in the end, and I'm not that I don't like ambiguity, but you got to go, like, full ambiguity. There's enough reality here that makes me think there's a reality happening. I don't care for that. Fortunately, the number 7 film, Maelstrom, almost completely throws reality out the door. It's, if I remember correctly, Denis Villeneuve's second film. It has features Marie-Josée Croze in a very early performance by her. She plays, interestingly, someone who's in the fashion, because we have the character is a model in 30 Seconds of August, but she's kind of messed up. She's kind of a legacy. Her mother was like a fashion designer or a model or something, and so she's trying to figure her own stuff out. She gets drunk one night, accidentally hits a fishmonger, and the whole movie is kind of this meditation on, like, is it fate? Or is it, like, an accident? Is, like, just a coincidence? And it's really interesting to watch watch all of it come together, like, and really subtly hint at these questions. And it makes you wonder, like, is she a dark angel? Or is the Marie-Josée Coté's character just, like, a really messed up woman who just so happened to be a victim of circumstances? Left kind of ambiguous. This film is interesting, but it's also wrapped around this narrative device of this weird looking animatronic fish that is constantly getting skewered, and then another fish comes out and then continues the story, and then it gets chopped up and it looks like delicatessen. I don't mean a delicatessen, I mean that movie Delicatessen. it's bizarre and over the top, and it just looks ugly. The whole screen is colored red. It's terrible. It looks terrible. I could have done without the talking fish in Maelstrom. At number six, we get Blade Runner 2049. Somehow, and there are a lot of people like me who are extremely skeptical of this whole concept of, like, 35 years later, let's make a Blade Runner sequel. Because, I mean, everyone was digging up old IP at the time, you know, from, like, Tron Legacy to Prometheus and Alien Covenant, which were also Ridley Scott joints. Star Wars The Force Awakens, and just, like, all of it is, like, let's bring something old back. Get one or two of the actors, bring in a new actor, and we'll let it rip. But Blade Runner 2049 does manage to basically justify its own existence. And that's largely because it leaps off that original source material to tell an entirely different story, or to tell a similar story to Blade Runner, but in, like, a very different way. And manages to sequester a lot of that, like, honorific nostalgia stuff. It's a beautiful film. Ryan Gosling is really good as the lead character, this replicant who has to hunt other replicants. A lot of great performances in it. Just better than we deserve. And naturally, it was not as successful as the latest Marvel movie. Of course, how could it be? It's almost 3 hours long, and nobody lifts a magical hammer. But I digress. At number five, I have Polytechnique, which is Villeneuve's film. You can't really say it's, like, based on, although it is obviously based on the terrorist attack on January 6th, 1989, at L'École Polytechnique. It features kind of, like, real-life stories, like, names have been changed. Marc Le Pen does not get named in it. The character who is the Le Pen surrogate is just identified as the killer. But it's not quite based on, but it is clearly based on. It lives in this kind of weird void, and of course added to that is it's shot in black and white. I don't know if it's just me or if I remember, like, some of the songs wrong, but, like, it uses a number of 80s tunes in it, but they sound, like, kind of like they're off tempo, or it's, like, it's a different arrangement or something. So even, like, the familiar things in it, like the music on the radios and things, it just feels off, and that's a very powerful feeling in this movie. Just everything seems off as everybody's kind of going about their day, and then some crazy person... some hateful, crazy person comes in and starts shooting up the school, with specific evidence on the women, because everyone he shot was a woman. Everyone he killed was a woman at that, and it balances that with this other storyline about another male character who's basically, as the massacre is happening, is, like, running around the school trying to get help and then trying to deliver medical aid. And then there's also a part of the film that deals with the casual misogyny that, you know, when taken to extremes, ends up in a result of, like, a terrorist attack. But, I mean, it's about this woman, Valerie, who is a mechanical engineer, and you see her going into, like, an interview for this internship, and the professor looks at her resume, and he's like, oh, you want to be a mechanical engineer? That's weird, because most women want to go into civil engineering because it makes it easier for them to have families. So just, like, that sort of casual... misogyny is as relevant and as portrayed in the film as the more extreme end. And of that, this is a tight 76 minutes, but it feels like it's twice as long. And I don't mean that in a bad way. It just, like, that's how harrowing it, the way Villeneuve made it. At number four, we have Encendie, which was Villeneuve's movie. It was submitted to the Academy Awards as Best Foreign Language Picture, I think, in 2011. It did not win, though. It's a shame. It's a powerful movie about forgiveness and letting go of anger and love. It's so complicated. The plot is so complicated, I can't really get into it with time's left, but it is one of those movies where, as things kind of unfold, and as you realize, I'll call it a twist, although I don't think it's really kind of, like, meant to be, like, a like pop around the corner and there's a twist. It very carefully leads you up to it, but it is heartbreaking in the end when you do see the full picture. At number three, we have Prisoners. It's stark, but it's played so normally too. Like, there's a very simple mystery at the heart of it. Like, these two young girls were taken, but it leads to this like much more intricate mystery that brings in like various disparate figures that just shows how interconnected all of this is, and it's beautifully laid out, and there's such great performances in it from Hugh Jackman and Paul Dano, Jake Gyllenhaal again, Terrence Howard, and Melissa Leo is frightening in the film. She is frightening to watch. Really great performance by her. The Arrival is my number two. And this was a science fiction movie about a first contact situation. Interestingly, I mean, it's sort of been done, this idea of first contact has been done so often in various Hollywood movies, but rarely does like a first contact movie ever like really sell you on the alienness of the alien contact. And that's what this movie does really, really well, is the struggles to communicate, the subtleties of communication. How, as human beings, we have difficulty communicating with each other, let alone communicating with a whole other vastly different alien race. And it's all connected with this deeply personal story of this woman who you think is going through some sort of trauma, the loss of her child, and the twist is that she's actually, through her communications with the aliens, seeing the future. And that is, again, that's another sort of little Villeneuve twist that's handled very, very carefully. He doesn't really spring it on you. There's a point as you watch Arrival through for the first time, it occurs to you. When it occurs to you that you're actually seeing the future, you're seeing flash forwards, not flashbacks. It's a really beautiful, really remarkable point in the film. That brings me to my number one, which is Sicario, which is almost the antithesis of every action movie, because the good guy does not win at the end. The politics are dirty and completely immoral. Basically, all our heroine can do, which is played by Emily Blunt, who plays this FBI agent who's trying to deal with the drug smuggling situation on the border, all she can basically do is, you know, quit and walk away and leave it to these scumbags with badges who are playing cowboy along the border. And that's kind of rare in a movie like this, where the very Hollywood way of doing this would be to like go direct in and shoot him up and take out all the bad guys, and heroes win, bad guys lose. But that's not what Sicario is about, and that's what makes it very, very interesting and memorable indeed. Okay, Steve Kraft, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you for inviting me. This is an opportunity that I don't get too often, that is to say, to talk to you. So what a pleasure.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I wanted to ask you this question first. You know, we're a couple of weeks out from the groundbreaking of the new library building. I'm wondering, do you ever wake up in the morning and wonder if it's all a dream?
I know, exactly. Good question, Adam. Thank you for that. You know, I do think it's actually going to happen, so that's great. But I do appreciate your column, you know, and you mentioned, you know, about slipping on a banana peel at the 1 yard line, and things could still happen. Do you know what I mean? That are way out of my control. But I do have confidence that, as I say, the shovels are going to be in the ground in the next few weeks. So, you know, keep an eye out for that when you're walking by.
Fair enough. So one of the reasons we're talking is it's your 40th year working at the Guelph Public Library. So congratulations.
Yep. Happy anniversary. Yep. All that stuff.
We live in times where that kind of longevity at a place of work is rare. Did you think, you know, the first day on the job, you would still be at the Guelph Public Library 4 decades later?
Absolutely not. I mean, like I was 22 years old, okay, and I was fresh. I think I was still in library school. It was one of the last few weeks of library school when I came for the interview, and I had no idea where Guelph was. I mean, I got a vague idea, but being 22, I mean, you're kind of wrapped up in yourself. So I came for the interview. I just wanted a good experience. Then I didn't hear from them, and a couple of weeks later, they offered me the job, and I thought, well, no one else has offered me a job. I guess I better take it. And I was only going to be here, you know, because I knew everything at 22 years old. I was only going to be here for a year. And then I don't know what I was going to do after that. But nevertheless, no, I had no idea it was going to be 40 years. And you're absolutely right. That is unusual. I mean, this in this day and age, I mean, like, what do people have an average of five, six, seven jobs in their lifetime these days?
Yeah.
You know, I'm unsure of the statistic, but you know, government employees, whether they're municipal, federal, or provincial, that kind of thing. I mean, you know, I mean, historically they would stay in the job for a long time, but these days it's a little bit unusual. And I have been very lucky and very blessed. This is a great place to work. Okay. I haven't always done the job of CEO, but you know, I worked my way up through the organization and was, as I say, was lucky enough to get this job, and it's a really good gig. So.
You remember you started in the children's library, didn't you?
I did, and I was nervous as hell, if I can use that word on a podcast, because I had no idea what being a public librarian was like, let alone a children's librarian. So they wanted me to do story time, and I was, oh, for days, you know, ahead of time, I was nervous, so nervous. But I got through it, and apparently I was good at it. You know, back in, you know, the kids would just, you know, inch closer to you and closer to you, and you're reading the story. Next thing you know, they're like, you know, they're leaning on your shoulder while you're reading the story. And these days you have to be very careful about what you do in, you know, a public format like that. But I mean, the kids were just wonderful. I really did enjoy it. It was exhausting, but fun. So,
what made you choose the I know it's technically the library sciences, but it's also a bit the library arts. But what put you in that direction to make that a life's work?
I had no idea what I was going to do. I mean, to tell you the truth, I mean, I knew I needed a job. And when I was in school, I was working part time, just a few hours a week in the library. And I thought it was maybe something I could do. And I talked to one of the librarians there, and I said to Pam, I wanted to go to library school. And she said, no, no, Steve, you don't want to do that. And I said, yeah, Pam, I think I do. And it did work out for me. So they accepted me into the graduate program. I graduated. And it really, I mean, for someone who was curious, someone who has a history, I have a history and an English literature background, this is a great opportunity for me. I mean, you can just, I mean, the work can be demanding and challenging in many different ways, but I mean, it certainly does feed my curiosity and my intellectuality. I mean, if you can say something snotty like that, right?
Right. But you know, you come into the job, it's 1983. Not to put a date on it, but there it is.
That was the date.
That was the date. You know, we start to, I mean, that's about the time you start seeing, you know, Apple IIs everywhere in classrooms and things. That's, you know, when we start getting into, you know, keeping information on disks and things and just the availability of the technology. And now to look back now, I mean, were you aware, I mean, in so much as anyone's kind of aware, but were you aware just how drastically the technology was going to change your job even 40 years ago?
No, not at all. Because I mean, we'd had a certain amount of, I think there were one or two courses that we took in computer training and, you know, designing things, programming, that kind of thing. But I mean, I had no idea how it was going to change, absolutely. And I think, I mean, I joined a group of librarians who were very rooted in traditional methods and things like that. We had the card catalog, obviously. And I think when I got here, there might have been one or two computers in the library, but they were just used to build indexes, okay. And so yeah, I mean, which was fine. I mean, like, but as you say, you know, even a few years, 5 or 10 years later, I mean, like, you know, we were getting rid of the card catalog, and the computer, those early computers were kind of scary, but my God, they helped me too. I mean, because I mean, like, card catalog, you really had to rely on your brain. And, you know, thinking up the proper subject headings or where to find information. Sometimes it was just by serendipity you got lucky, but with the computer, it was more organized, and you could feed in a word, a keyword, and it would, you know, spark some results, which would spark your brain to move even further. Now, of course, computers are much more sophisticated, and you can barely you barely need to finish typing the word before you've, you know, found your results. So I had no idea. And the same thing with your phone too. I mean, like, I'm picking up my phone now. I mean, like, you know, what I've got in my hand doesn't resemble anything that we had 10 years ago, right?
Yeah.
And 10 years from now, this is going to be obsolete. So who knows where things are going? I mean, these are exciting times. So
does that, you know, make you wonder, like, the Steve Kraft who's starting in a children's library somewhere today, maybe on a course to become the CEO of their library. Like, what does a library look like in 40 years?
Well, that's just it. That's a good question, right? I think in many ways, I mean, the books aren't going away. That's one thing we've discovered after COVID. Okay. Mm. I mean, like, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, our services certainly pivoted, with, to use that horrible, you know, overused word. But when we reopened to the public, The circulation in hard copy has rebounded and exploded. It's become much larger than it was before COVID. Okay, so during COVID, people were using electronic resources, which was just, I mean, marvelous to see. But they've returned to the hard copy. I think people still want that physical feeling of turning a page, right? Now, mind you, a lot of seniors, if we, you know, love their iPads and their Kindles and et cetera, because they do facilitate their active lifestyle, let's say. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But I myself love books. So 40 years from now, who knows? We're still going to have libraries. We're still going to have those community hubs that people need. I mean, people can come in here, use all the resources, say hello to Steve or Dan or whoever's, you know, behind the desk, that kind of thing. And it's kind of an event in your day. So
it does seem that the library has sort of become, I mean, it's not to say that it's sort of future proof in that, you know, the library has certainly adapted in a lot of ways, but I think we've talked about this before. I remember a teacher I had in elementary school who would say, and this was like 1989, he'd say, like, you know, in 10 years, there's going to be no more libraries. And like, he was envisioning like that future where everybody had like access to a library on a Kindle or something. Like, we didn't know what it would be called, but that was sort of his vision of what the future is. And library space, I mean, granted, you go into the library, it's not just the book stacks anymore. It's meeting space, it's tech space, it's maker space, but the books are still there. You see them when you walk in. And it just seems like, despite the technological changes, and you can get books on, you know, tablets and Kindles and things, but the idea of holding that physical book is just something even young people can't get over.
Exactly right. I mean, like, and just as an example, picture books haven't made the transition yet to or at least successfully to a digital format. I'm not sure about cookbooks either. I mean, you can buy cookbooks in a digital format, but I still want to, you know, have the book propped open on the counter when you're doing something like that. I'm thinking, you know, something that did disappear were the auto repair manuals. Okay. We don't have as many of those. And I'm not sure, maybe people aren't repairing their own autos like they used to anymore because they're more complicated.
Yeah.
But I mean, some books have disappeared, obviously, but the majority, I mean, there's still an audience for reading a physical copy, a hard copy. Yeah.
You know, the weird thing about picture books, you see picture books, and I would think that'd be one of the things that would make it like sort of an easier transition because, you know, you could, on the tablet, move the thing around, zoom in, you know, you're not constrained by a page, like a 11 by 17 page or however big it is. It's kind of weird.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, like, there probably are options there because you could touch the page, move in, zoom in and look at the turtle or the snake or something like that. Or, right. I mean, zoom in or it'll give yourself some information or not. But I mean, babies, you know, are still, I think, are very tactile. They want to get very sensory, you know, sensory oriented, but you know, I mean, like a board book is still something light, and it's got 3 or 4 or 5, 10 pages maybe at the most. But I don't see them holding up an iPad mini at this point. but you're right, but technology is going to change. So
yeah, Yeah. I know my 9-month-old nephew is very tactile at the moment. I have the pinches to prove it.
Bite marks, yeah.
Not quite, not quite. He's very private about his teeth. He is growing teeth, but he won't let you look at them. It's yeah, it's very unusual. Anyway, back to you. I wanted to ask this question because it's come up in the library board meetings a couple of times. This idea that the library is a bit bigger than just like the repository of knowledge and all those changes. It's becoming as much sort of a social services space now. And in talking about the future, I'm just wondering, in regards to that, are we, I mean, adapting? Is there like a fulsome understanding, I guess, on the part of just sort of like average community members, just how much of your day is like the helping people with sort of like basic living assistance in terms of like finding services, finding information, finding jobs, finding help, whatever that is, you know, are you as much social workers now as you are librarians?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And that all those things that you just listed there, I mean, are things that we have always done. Okay, we've always been there for people, but I mean, there are certainly more people out there in the community who need that specialized assistance. Okay, and we certainly do that. And some libraries have invested in social workers too. Now, as I've said, right now in our community, I don't think I need to do that. At least not at this point, because we have some such good assistance in with using other agencies in the community. Welcoming Streets, Stepping Stones, Stonehenge, things like that. These are all resources. I mean, they have staff that we can call upon if we do need assistance, right? And I'll say that to mean the traditional support services like mental health or the police and the fire department and the ambulance, I mean, are always there when we need them. They have never failed us. Okay. So, as I say, I mean, I think I'm quite proud right now, and I'm going to knock wood here because I'm probably going to jinx myself, but we have it under control here. Okay. I mean, some libraries have it much more severe than we do. Okay. I know, let's use Toronto as an example. I mean, of their 100 branches, maybe like a quarter of them, maybe like 25 of them have, customers with acute issues, okay, whether it's drug addiction or mental health, or even, I mean, some of them can be violent as well. But I mean, like right now, Canada being, what is it, the third, safest city, or sorry, Guelph being the third safest city in, Canada, we really don't have that yet. And as I say, I am quite happy that the library is able to manage those customers as well as we do. Okay, so we know a lot of them by name. So I mean, like, hi Steve, hi Adam, that kind of thing, right? I mean, how you doing today? And some people are having, more trouble than others. But what's really nice too is that our regular customers, should, I mean, I hate to, identify them as regular or irregular, but I mean, like, come here, on a regular basis. I mean, they're all part of the community. They all do accept that. Okay. I mean, like, there's someone who's having trouble here. I'm, and this, hello, how are you? So it's a, we're all getting along together nicely at this point anyway. So.
And there's a quality to that in the library, and this is something that's been noted in a lot of different people in a lot of different ways. Library is one of the few places where you don't kind of have to have like a specific reason to be there. You could go on the computer, you can check out the book, you can check out the 3D printer, you can check out the DVDs or whatever. There's no cost for entry. If you sit down at a table, you don't have to order a drink. It's community, it's true community space.
It's true community space. It's the last free space, let's say. I mean, maybe I'm over exaggerating, but it's the last free space. You can come in and do a jigsaw puzzle if you like and just talk to Yvonne or something like that while you're doing it, that kind of thing. You can bring a coffee in if you want. I mean, that's great. I'm not going to encourage you to, eat a, turkey dinner, but if that's what you want to do today, if that was your reason for being here, just be careful, okay, and enjoy yourself. So.
In keeping that though, and I appreciate your knocking wood, in thinking about all the changes in the future, I mean, I think there's an idea here that, and it may not be completely trickled through to the rest of the community yet, that just this idea that libraries are not just about where you go to get the books and stuff. It could be a community center, and it might, you know, we don't know the future, but you know, it's conceivable we might get to the point where the library does have like an official social worker on staff or a nurse, because that's, I mean, again, it's, everyone knows where the library is. It's access is relatively easy, and it's just the place people go when they need knowledge and help finding knowledge. And so it's probably not that unreasonable to think that that kind of service could extend to the body as well as the mind at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like we were joking amongst ourselves, some days we need a therapist, right? I mean, you know, and I'm sorry, I mean, I do make light of a lot of things, but I mean, it's sure. True, right? I mean, like, you know, I mean, a social worker would be great. So we're just, at this point, we don't need it. We're very careful with our budget, okay? But when we open that new library, okay, it is meant to be flexible. The space is meant to be flexible. So it will grow and shrink, like a room will grow and shrink as we need it, that kind of thing. There's going to be lots of meeting space. It's going to be open, you know, after hours if we need it. So let's say if Steve's going to get married for the second or third time, I mean, like, you can rent a space and you know, and celebrate after hours. Okay. There's going to be some outdoor space. There's going to be that creative space. There's going to be lots of technology too. I mean, like, you know, people are still reading books, but I mean, it's going to morph into, like, you know, streaming services. I mean, we offer streaming services now, but what do those look like in the future? And many people in this day of economic uncertainty, I like to say, I mean, like, listen, I have a good job. I can afford to buy books, but I don't always want to buy them. I don't always want to own them and keep them forever. So that's why I use the library a lot, right? It's an economically, environmentally sound thing to do, okay? I mean, let's use Prince Harry's book as an example, Spare. Sure. I mean, we all wanted to read it, but do we want to have a copy on our shelf forever and ever? Amen?
Right.
So,
or donate it to the big book sale.
Donate it to the book sale, right, in September this year. So, yeah, I mean, the library will be flexible. It will always be a community space, okay, and it will reflect the community. So,
I'm gonna throw this out there because I know there are reasons, but the borrowing limit on Hoopla is killing me, Steve.
I know exactly. It's not the first time I heard that. So we are doing everything we can to make it more available to you as an addicted library user. Okay.
And fair enough.
And I thank you. Okay.
Fair enough. Well, you've opened the door to the new library building. I'm curious, how much of your day or week on average is sort of the effort to sort of get that ready to go? Not just like, I mean, construction obviously is not necessarily on your desk, but I mean, in terms of like the preparations, the sort of longer term preparations, that move is going to be a tough move in a couple of years.
Absolutely. How should I say? I mean, like, you know, right now, I mean, up until now, up until the groundbreaking, okay, I mean, a substantial portion of my week, you know, was dedicated to organizing things and making sure things were still on track. But it's nice to see now that we've passed that milestone, as I say, I have confidence that it is going to get built and there will be some a machinery on site digging that, you know, that those holes. but now we've got to sort of set our sights on, as you say, organizing things to make that move, and it's going to be large. And we have a project manager on staff now that we've hired who is going to look after that for us. So my day isn't necessarily consumed by that as much as it was, but I'm happy to manage and organize things and make sure that we are looking after, you know, is the, what furniture are we buying, that kind of thing. What are we doing for that opening day collection, so on and so forth. I mean, are the, you know, staff. We have to hire. Listen, I mean, like, you know, we're almost tripling the size from this location to the new one.
Yeah,
and we have to hire more staff. Okay, so I mean, like, we make sure that we're making good hires. Okay, I mean, like, we're not going to do it. You can't just, you know, go from nothing to something on opening day. So we have to gradually, you know, hire people and to make sure everything's in place for that. So that's, you know what, and that's an exciting time. I mean, that makes being a librarian fun. So
does sort of, I mean, tripling the size, that's, I mean, that it just sounds incredible. Is that daunting in any way for you as a manager?
You know what? No, I haven't even thought of it that way. I mean, like, you know, because I mean, it's the KPMG, you know, business case decided, and rightly so, that that's the correct size, correct square footage is at 88,000 square feet for a city of that's growing. So, I mean, I'm confident that we're moving in the right direction. The design looks great. I think you're going to be really pleased, and you're going to want to stay much longer. You want to do Hoopla at home. You want to come here to the library and you know and watch and participate in everything. So it really will be a great place to come. It'll be a nice attraction.
I want to pause
So.
and geek out for a minute because I mean, I was at the groundbreaking. I knew it would attract a lot of attention, at least so far as dignitaries go. Like, I knew there'd be library board past and present, there'd be city councilors past and present. There was, I mean, I don't want to assign like supernatural qualities to it, but it was a bit weird. It was like half of downtown was drawn there for half an hour to see this thing.
Yeah, absolutely, right? I mean, and did you notice everybody wanted to hold a shovel and you know what, throw some dirt in the air, right? That was really cool. I like that. So,
And you
yeah,
brought
you're
a
right.
special shovel, William Tytler shovel.
Which I, you know, up until the day of, I didn't know really existed. I know we had a lot of fun things. There's a lot of treasure to be found in our archives, such as it is. And Dan, bless his little pointed head, brought that shovel to me and said, "Here, use this, okay?" So I said, "What is that?" Yeah, and it was William Tytler's shovel, which is very cool, huh? It was cool.
Was a little cool.
Yeah.
I want to look around at the libraries because I think, you know, and you will agree, you don't want to make you don't want those branches to sort of get lost in the
Yeah.
transition here. What is the future for, or I guess the immediate future, as you know, all the eyes are kind of downtown. You know, what does it look like for those branches? And I mean, have you thought far out into where the library might expand next?
I suspect, yeah, okay. I mean, like people will criticize us and say, "Why are you building that big library downtown when my branch library is sufficient and it's all I need?" And those people will never leave their branch library. I shouldn't say never, but I mean, like, they love their branch library, and I love them for loving it. Okay, it's a big love fest, flower power and everything. But that central library feeds those branches, okay, and it makes sure that you have a good experience and all the material that you need in those branches because of the central library. It's still a growing city, you know. I mean, that's a separate topic of conversation, and we need to grow quickly according to the, you know, legislation and desire of the provincial government. So, and yeah, as you also know, the city is projected to expand south of Clare Road. So, I don't know. Do we have? There'll probably be a branch south of Clare Road, or is Westminster Square branch enough to service that entire area for the time being? Okay, so that's something that we'll hire a consultant to do a study for us. Okay, sort of it's like a growth study, or and just to see where the next service area will be. Okay, but there'll be something out there. I mean, like in the next 10, 15 years, as Clare Road, if that's what we're calling it, comes online, then we'll need to be part of that as well. Are we part of a school? Are we part of a rec center? Are we part of, you know, something else? You know, I would love to be next to an LCBO or a Tim Hortons or a grocery store because, I mean, like their customers, I mean, like it's one-stop shopping for people. So, yeah.
It makes sense to combine a library amongst a commercial area,
Yeah.
because it is that one-stop shopping. And to further add to the point too, if you go to any library branch on a Saturday, it's not empty. It's a
It's not empty.
wherever
Yeah.
you go, it's busy.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, you know, our programming has really exploded, especially for young people. Okay. I mean, like, those kids are coming back in droves. There was baby time. What do we call it? There's baby massage. Okay. That was yesterday morning, I think. Anyway, I mean, like, all these programs are great. So, loving it.
And again, this is something that you kind of only clue into if you go to the board meetings, but you know, your staff are doing a lot right now and you know, maybe overtaxed to a certain extent, but trying to like keep up with the programming. So, you know, people may just sort of look at the growth that's coming to the with the new main branch, but it's completely justified growth, right? You know, you have one, I think there's one person on your staff right now who does all programming. But do I have that right?
We have one manager whose area of concentration is programming, but right now we have Andrea, who's our full-time programmer, and then we have some part-timers as well. But right. You're absolutely correct. I mean, there are expectations that programming is offered, I mean, in the library, through the library system, and that's something that we're going to need to develop higher for as we get closer to the building or opening that new central library. Okay. Mm-hmm. When this library that I'm sitting in right now was built, I mean, there was never any expectation of providing adult programming. It was mostly for children, okay? And so that's why we've had a tough time of, trying to provide those streams, adult and children's and or teen programming as well. So, I mean, like, and rightly so, people have expectations. And as taxpayers, I want to take advantage of all that, that sort of thing, because there are wonderful opportunities out there. Speaker series, engineering programs, STEAM, that kind of thing, right? So, and a good library is a reflection of a good community, okay? Mm-hmm. So, and we need to provide all those things to people, just to... make them better citizens, okay? So critical thinkers, as I said. We need more critical thinkers. So.
Yeah, that's almost an entirely separate topic. If you could change anything about the library, regardless of budget or politics, what would you do if you just had the power to sort of affect change?
Ooh. You should have given me that question ahead of time. I don't know. But I mean, like, I'm really in a happy place right now because that new central library is happening. That would have been my wish. I mean,
right.
a few years ago is just get that thing built. But no, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, maybe... better marketing or something like that. I don't know. If I had a huge marketing budget, I think I'd like to reach out there and just sort of pull in those people who try to pull back those people who don't believe in libraries anymore for whatever, silly reason they have these thoughts. But I mean, I couldn't survive without a library, and I'd like to be able to, reassure people or convince people that it's as necessary as I believe they are. So,
well, let me look at the question a different way then. We're talking about the nebulous future and not being sure what's coming next. But I mean, from where you're sitting right now, is there anything a library can't do?
Well, I mean, we can't repair your car what can't we do? You know something? Listen, that's a good question. But I mean, like, when we do get requests, we do try to fulfill them, okay, as much as we can. So, I don't know. Going forward, I would just like to see more people writing and more people publishing, and and just have more readers reading that kind of thing. So, yeah.
Well, I think that's a wish that can probably be granted. But Steve Kraft, again, congratulations on 40 years and thank you for all your hard work. And thank you for joining us here today. It's appreciated.
Thank you again for having me. It's always a pleasure. So,
and that's it for this week's show. I hope you liked it. And if you want to listen to more Guelph Politicast stuff, you can go to the Guelph Politicast channel and download us every Wednesday from Apple, Google, TuneIn, and Spotify. You can also subscribe to the Guelph Politicast channel and get every episode of Open Sources Guelph on Mondays and every episode of End Credits when they come out on Fridays. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics and Sid Dale. You can follow Guelph Politico on social media at Guelph Politico on Twitter and at Politico Guelph on Facebook. You can follow me at Adam A. Donaldson on Twitter and Instagram, or send me an email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. If you'd like to help financially support the work of Guelph Politico, you can get all that information at guelphpolitico.ca/donate. And finally, for all the latest local political news, you can check out guelphpolitico.ca, where there will be a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you next week. And until then...